You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Underground. Sorry, guys. Talking about Soviet Union in the 80s and probably now. Well, anyway, who talks about the Soviet Union because it doesn't exist anymore? These guys right here. Welcome to another edition of MMA for the Mind. You want to be a mixed martial artist? Well, then you tune in to Hunter Motz talking and Brian Callen reaffirming what he says and then throwing in little things that support what he says.
Brian, that's very modest, which is very much, you know, very much in the spirit of mixed mental arts, because you're adopting that beginner's mind.
That's so right,
it's
buddy.
It's like Socrates. You say, I know nothing, but really we know you're a genius.
Well, and you know, in the academic circles, they call me Baby Socrates.
Really?
Yeah, BS. the acronym, the abbreviation, whatever.
I was thinking about that too, right? Like a lot of people call this the BCS.
Is that an acronym when you say the BS would be an acronym for Baby Socrates? Acronym, yeah.
But anyway, I was thinking about this, you know, like the BCS, right? Because we stand in between the bullshit, right? Like, wow.
Damn!
There is no I in team, but there is a C in between the bullshit, that's the Brian Callen Show. Is it?
That's so good. I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, there really is only one podcast. When you want to learn. I do look forward to these conversations. I really do, because so much of what I talk about and what I am involved in is not these discussions. You're somebody who seems not only to read everything, but to retain and put it all together.
Well, we can talk about why that is, right? And that comes down to how human memory works.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I do, because I want to learn a little bit more about how to do that.
Well, the key is that it's not just taking in the information. It's trying to organize it to use it for some sort of purpose, right?
Yeah.
So I wasn't intentionally doing this way back when, but a lot of this for me comes back to an experience I had during the 2000 presidential election, where, you know, I had come to this country as a foreigner, essentially, right? Even though I had American citizenship. And, you know, so I wasn't sure, am I a Republican or a Democrat? And so, you know, I wandered around the Harvard campus and heard a lot of Democratic points of view. And then I found the three conservatives on campus and I tried to hear what they had to say. Right.
Yeah, Harvard.
Well, my favorite thing along those lines is, you know what Nixon used to call Harvard, right?
No.
The Kremlin on the Charles, which is totally true.
Yeah.
And it has only become more that way over time.
Yeah.
But so, you know, I listened to all these sorts of things and I like, it all sort of like vaguely, like I got that, you know, this made sense to them, but none of it particularly made sense to me. And, you know, so I read things and I did all these things. And then on election day, I wandered in and, you know, I sat there in the polling booth and I looked at this ballot and I was like, I had a vague feeling about who I should vote for as president.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I have always a vague feeling.
Yeah. But I didn't really understand, like, I didn't have any clear rationale for why I was doing this. And then by the time you got down to, like, senators, congressmen, you know, the sanitation commissioner, like, these really all the way down the ballot, like, I didn't even have a feeling.
Of course not.
I was like, who are these people? And then do I vote just along party lines? What do I do? And so, to me, like you, having grown up all over the world and seen great poverty from inside an air-conditioned car, you know, that was disturbing because I know how much the U.S. election matters to the entire world.
Yeah.
And so I was like, this is sad. Like, I need to figure out, I need to, one time in my life, I would like to feel good about my vote.
Yeah.
And that, and as I've gone on and as I've read more and more and more about this, all in terms of trying to get a coherent worldview to be able to vote, I've come to realize that there aren't any options on the table currently that would allow me to do that.
There aren't many options on the table.
There aren't any. I think what's happened is if you think about something like liberal versus conservative, right? These are complementary mindsets. They're not opposing mindsets, right? It's old versus new.
Yeah.
And if you think there's the old thing about reinventing the wheel, right? We say, oh, you know, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. In practice, that's what human progress is. If you look at a wagon wheel, it's wooden.
Yeah.
And if you look at a modern car tire, it's they've kept the same basic shape, but then they've reinforced it with the best materials of the day, steel, rubber, all that sort of stuff. So all of human history is reinventing the wheel.
Yeah.
But the key is that you have to figure out the baby from the bathwater. What are the old parts that you should preserve?
Mm-hmm.
And then where can you reinforce things with the best materials of the day?
Mm-hmm.
So what's ended up happening is that if you look at the Republican and the Democratic Party, they've chased each other to opposite ends of the spectrum on a whole bunch of issues until both of them aren't really grounded in reality. So if you take something like education, you know, Democrats usually focus on things like the conditions that the poor grow up in, you know, what are the conditions of these schools, teacher salaries, all of that sort of stuff, right? But they, if you start trying to talk to them about how culture or beliefs and values might affect educational outcomes, they don't really want to hear it. You know, their minds
what I always seem to see with the mindset of a Republican, a mindset of a Democrat, the philosophy, the broad stroke philosophy that I always gather is Democrats tend to say, look, there are inequalities and there are some fat cats making lots of money. What we need to do is figure out a way to get all that unfair money that they're making and give it to the people that are struggling, working hard, and super virtuous. Because, you know, they can't send their kids to baseball camp and right. all that stuff. Okay, so let's figure out a way to, let's push some taxes through, let's do this, that, and the other thing, let's give tax incentives to maybe smaller businesses, but, you know, a lot. And then the Republicans have the other point of view, which is dog-eat-dog, Darwinian world, pick yourself up by your bootstraps, be a man,
right.
you know, true grit, vigorous civilizations have rough sports and fist fights. And it's just these two kind of like, these two opposing philosophies. And then, of course, what happens is one side extrapolates and says, you guys are pussies and you don't produce anything. You just read books and reason and theorize. And then the other side says, oh, God, these
anti-intellectual Neanderthals.
These white guys with all their money and their facts and whatever it might be. That seems to be what people hold on to.
Yeah.
And getting them to vote for their concept and their perception of what that other side represents.
100%.
And who that other side is gunning for.
Right.
Is very difficult to change.
See, Brian, there you took the lead. See, that's the point. It's a, you can't have good.
But you were talking about how you learned to essentially put these things together in a useful fashion. So taking facts, taking your education, and making it practical.
Right. And what this practical is a key word here. Okay?
Because remember, so many things that we like, Black Lives Matter.
Right.
What's going on now with our perception of what the police are doing to black people. Most of us, white people, black people, whoever it might be, it's on both sides. We don't know what to do about the problem.
Right.
Black people don't. I don't. That's where a lot of the frustration is. So let's march in the street. Let's say something's got to change. I get it. Then you have a certain black people saying, look, the system has been rigged from the beginning. Know that. And you have white people like me going, yeah, you're right. But sorry.
Right.
I still have my house in Calabasas. I don't know what to do about that. But I do feel badly about it. You know.
Right. Well, I think that the crucial thing here is to remember, you know, and this is something I've talked about before, and the key thing is from all of these things that I've read, right, I'm going to be pulling out certain ideas that we're going to use as touchstones.
Yeah.
Because these are essentially the core principles that are going to be able to, fundamentals that will guide you again and again and again in making sense of these things.
Yeah.
So in Joe Henrich's book, there's that graph, right? And that graph is you take a toddler and you test its, you know, spatial intelligence, its causal reasoning intelligence, and its social intelligence. And you compare it to you do the same thing to a chimp and an orangutan. Right. And so in terms of spatial awareness, right, trying to figure out the world, shapes, all of that sort of stuff, human toddler is no better than a chimp or an orangutan. OK, in terms of causal reasoning, right, figuring out why things happen, no better than a chimp or an orangutan.
A little better, I guess.
No better.
OK.
Right.
No better.
The thing that our superpower is social intelligence, because what ends up happening
we can borrow ideas.
We can borrow them. We can test them. We can remix them. All the stuff that people do on the internet where they take and break and remake, that's what we do well. And that's how tools and all of these other things have improved over time. right? There is a whole group of people whose whole job is to make better explanations for why things happen, and they're called scientists. And, you know, if you talk to any scientist, like if you talk to Joe Henrich or John Haidt, right, who really understands what's going on, then they will tell you that individually scientists are not that smart. But collectively, they have the potential to come up with some pretty good explanations. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The problem is that scientists in general don't actually value social intelligence that much because they're trapped in these enlightenment intuitions about reason.
Well, right? They're right. So in other words, the idea that human beings are rational.
Right. Yeah. So what's happened is that science itself as a culture has not fully embraced its findings, right? Because cultures take time, and what you ultimately have to do is reach down and change those intuitions. So the hard thing about this moment is not that we don't have the answers. There are people who have thought about these things for a long time and tried to understand these things, but they've all been sitting in science. And if you read any one of these books, it's not going to make sense. But if you read across a lot of them, then you start to get a clear picture, right? So the first thing that we're going to talk about in terms of Black Lives Matter is the Dunbar number. Okay, so the Dunbar number is very simple, and it's just that essentially there's a certain number of humans that you can hold in your head.
1,500, I think.
Well, there's a series of Dunbar numbers. So 150 is the one that Malcolm Gladwell talks about, but there is actually a 1,500 level, right? And it's the difference between there are friends, there are acquaintances, there are the three or four people that you like really can trust and really rely on and would totally open up to. So there's actually a series of Dunbar numbers, but whatever that Dunbar number is, it is not 7 billion, right? There is no human that can handle that many relationships.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a difference between having a relationship with someone and being able to remember their name, mm-hmm. right? Which is a totally different thing, right? But even so, you find this, and you know, naturally your brain is always pruning these relationships out. So what ends up happening is that, you know, we all got on Facebook, we got so excited, and we're like, I'm going to have a million friends,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And then you friend all these people, and then and, you know, some years go by and you're like, who is this person?
Yeah.
And why do they keep on popping up in my Facebook feed? And I have totally forgotten about them.
Yeah.
And that's why when, you know, the experience of running into someone in the street and you're like, oh, so-and-so who I have not seen in so long, so good to see you. But what you're both trying to almost avoid is having to like actually work on that relationship. Right, because working on relationships takes a lot of time and energy and all that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. And in fact, Dunbar's book, which the Dunbar number is the part that has floated out, there's actually much, much more interesting stuff in the book that did not float out, partly because it relies on sort of evolutionary thinking. And that is Dunbar's big conclusion is that the reason why we have language is that it primarily evolved to serve the function of grooming. So the way that chimps and orangutans and primates maintain social relationships is they groom each other,
yeah.
right? They eat each other's ticks and fleas and all that sort of stuff.
Delicious.
Yeah, delicious, right?
Yeah.
The problem is that, you know, every chimp or primate has a natural group size. And when you get up to the level of 150 individuals, right, which is sort of the level of a tribe, 100, 200, something like that.
And humans, yeah.
Humans, right? You would have to spend all your time grooming. You wouldn't be able to do anything else. You wouldn't be able to have sex. You wouldn't be able to go out hunting. You wouldn't be able to have food.
Yeah.
So humans evolved this mechanism, gossip, which is designed to basically groom each other. And so, you know, when you have that meaningless conversation with, you know, your friend or relative or whatever.
About someone else. It's bonding.
Or about weather. The topic doesn't matter.
No, some of the most joyous times of my life have been to talk behind even good friends' backs.
Yeah.
And it's of course I don't mean it. What we're doing is laughing at a moment a friend had.
Totally.
And even if the friend wanted to, like I had a friend who I really admire and I love, mm-hmm. and he was giving me some advice. He's a little younger than me, and his advice was bang on.
Right.
But if you were to look at both our lives on paper, I might be doing a little better,
mm-hmm.
right? Or maybe a lot better.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But that wasn't relevant. And he was right and he was helpful.
Right.
But there was humor in examining the fact that he was telling me something that at my age, I already know.
Yeah.
And I'm past. In other words, like if you want to talk to me about Rumi, or you want to talk to me about Osha, or you want to talk to me about Zen Buddhism, I'm going to fucking zone out.
Right.
And it's not because Osha, Rumi, and Zen doesn't have value. but go fuck yourself because I'm too busy and I'm living my goals.
Right.
And so there, the humor that I shared with my friend putting down a great guy was priceless. Yeah. We were laughing so hard and it was so much fun. I didn't mean it, but it was a form of bonding. And I guess what Dunbar would call grooming with my other buddy at the expense of an outstanding individual.
But also, crucially, humor is really important there because you have to understand that although we like analogize to apes, there are big differences, right? Hunter-gatherers are fundamentally egalitarian, right? They like equals. And so they do all these things to basically avoid any one of them having too much status. So they tease people who succeed. Like if you go out on a hunt and the guy, you know, nails a deer or whatever, they tease the guy. And that's so he doesn't get a big head. That's why we have political satire. That's why we have all these things.
Every culture that has been studied, according to, I think, Jared Diamond, is whether it was the Sioux, whether it was the Inuit, they all have a form of a humorous insult.
That's right.
They tease each other.
And it's all to basically make sure that what you're trying to deal with is you're trying to counteract the effects of power on people's psychology.
Yeah.
Right? So absolute power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? Lord.
Okay, so we've established that Dunbar's work is one of the concepts we should be talking about. Two is that we're not rational beings. We are intuitive beings.
That's right.
So when you start...
And that we're bad at causal reasoning. We're bad at figuring out why things happen.
Yeah. So, for example, with Black Lives Matter and this whole situation that's going on, when a Harvard economist, who happens to be African-American, actually, when he comes out and says, in fact... Black people aren't as likely to be shot as white people, but... Mm-hmm. There's other factors to be looked at. Yes, those stats are, they may
let's
be
assume they're
technically true.
Yeah.
They aren't actually helpful, and they aren't even true within certain context.
Right.
So perception and emotion, which are huge and really a huge part of this for the Black community especially,
stat
actually isn't very relevant because what matters is that there is something going on. We all know this.
Well, and that's where this all comes back to the Dunbar number, right? Yeah. Because if you talk to people on the level of their families, right, I don't have to convince you in terms of your own family that trust, how people feel, how think people perceive things, all of these sorts of things matter a whole lot.
Yeah.
The problem is in the long, long arc of human history back to the rise of agriculture is how do you scale, right? How do you have
if you're a Black guy from South Florida,
right,
and you know you're going to have a very different experience with the police,
of course,
and it might even be deserved. I don't know, but you know then you have to go all the way back to how were you raised and what kind of opportunities you have and all that stuff.
We're going
to
pick all of that apart,
but what I'm saying is that you know you can look at stats, but if you're a Black guy from South Florida and you lost two of your friends to a police shooting, justified or not,
right.
You're going to have a very, very different emotional reaction to what's really going on.
And we've also seen in general, part of I think what social media has revealed is the degree to which people gravitate towards the stats that already fit their preformed conclusion and what they want to believe and what they want to feel and all of that sort of stuff. And that's because one of the things that human beings do is they rationalize, right? And that goes back to the Ben Franklin cod story. So, you know, you feel like having some cod, you're a vegetarian, there's a conflict, then you see that the cod is opened and inside the cod are smaller fish and you say, ah, the cod are murderers. In order to protect the little fish, I must eat the cod!
Fish.
That's right. And so it's the same thing. You have whatever feelings or intuitions you have about this topic, right? Whether you're white or Black or a cop or whatever. And naturally, you're going to gravitate towards certain things that reinforce your preformed conclusions. Right?
Yeah, I was in London my buddy, in England and about an hour and a half outside of London, my buddy has 800 acres of land. He's made a fortune. Oh. And he needs to kill, by law for him, it's required that he kill 21 deer a year on his property because deer are overrun. That's all I needed to hear. Mm-hmm. We fitted a couple of sniper rifles, German sniper rifles, $15,000 a piece with silencers. And I was like, well, got to kill a deer because I'm helping this environment. Mm. And I found myself a deer who was minding his own fucking business. And I saw some antlers. I was like, that's a buck. That's another thing. All I got to hear, mm-hmm. I'm helping the environment.
Oh, totally.
And I shot that fucking deer and ate it. And I remember, and I did feel a little bad about killing some poor deer that was sitting there with my Blauser sniper rifle. But it was a goddamn good shot.
Yeah.
Got it right in the heart and lungs. Mm-hmm. Dropped it. It didn't feel a thing, in my opinion. And... but, you know, we do. We rationalize.
We pick,
I don't like killing beautiful, senseless animals.
Yeah, but, that's the thing. There are all these conflicting emotions around it, right? Yeah. You've got your feelings for the cute little deer.
That story
was
just for me to brag that I'm a good shot and that I kill deer.
Well, that's really what the purpose of this is. I mean, whether we solve Black Lives Matter or not, what really matters is, does the world know that Brian Callen is a great shot?
Yeah, and I'm really not a great shot. Oh. The deer was way closer than that, I'd like to admit.
The deer was actually tranquilized. Yeah. Was deer, asleep.
That's right. The deer was walked out on a leash.
Yeah, exactly. It was actually slightly dead already.
It wasn't a deer. It was a cow, and but dressed up to look like a deer. It was starving.
Yeah. So, but so we've got this Dunbar number that we're working with. But then on top of that, there's also, you know, in general, do people take the brand of their group seriously? Right. So I told you the story about the Emiratis, right? So in the UAE, which is on the Persian Gulf, right, they have tons and tons of money. And so there are all these young Emiratis who would go and they would get super fancy sports cars and then they'd race recklessly like Fast and the Furious around London. And they'd hurt people and they'd injure people and they'd, you know, crash and all that sort of stuff. And it became such a problem that it was giving the Emiratis a bad name. Mm-hmm. All Emiratis were suffering for the behavior of a few bad drivers. So the Emiratis put into place a new law, which was that if you committed any sort of traffic violation outside of the UAE, that it would be prosecuted inside the UAE. And wow. That deals with it.
Excellent, excellent
right.
job.
And so now what you're doing is you're policing the group. And in general, groups, especially so Americans generally have, there's a strong tendency, we'll talk about this, towards a dignity culture, where you don't focus on honor so much. And so what ends up happening is that we tend to underestimate bad actors within our group giving us a bad name. So a good example of this is Lena Dunham, right? So Lena Dunham, who did Girls, has, you know, there was this whole thing at Oberlin College about, you know, what kind of food they were serving in the dining room and the fact that in the dining hall they were serving sushi and banh mi, a Vietnamese sandwich, and they thought this was cultural appropriation.
Oh, my fucking God.
And, you know,
my God.
The media flipped out, like, who are these rich kids? Why are they worrying about this? They're lucky to be able to eat sushi, all these sorts of things, right? And Lena Dunham comes in and is like, no, I thought right on. Like, absolutely. Like, that is cultural appropriation, blah, 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 blah.
So what?
Well, the point...
Cultural appropriation is what this country is about.
Well, also, how do you... I mean, so much of the reason why I have a soft spot for so many cultures is because they fed me and because their food is delicious. Like, that's a large part of how you form a bond
Dunham
with them.
Came in. She's smarter than that.
Well, she should be. But the point is that... You know, she may be smart, but she's not necessarily wise. And if you've spent your life in the echo chamber of one culture, then you haven't necessarily...
Which
she did.
And is then she in New York?
She's from New York, yeah.
And she went to Oberlin?
She went to Oberlin,
naturally,
But so in practice, you know, if we're going to talk about cultural appropriation and we're going to fight that in food, then you no longer get to have pizza because pizza is the combination.
Obviously.
Yeah, pizza comes from Aztec tomatoes. Wheat is originally from the Arabian Peninsula. Cheese is probably from Turkey and oregano is probably from India. So the point is that all food is fusion food. Like anything that you eat that is delicious is the result of cultures exchanging food. Right. But so I post...
Tomatoes came from the New World.
Yeah, as did potatoes, as did all of these things, corn, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, when you have someone like Lena Dunham saying this, though, a liberal will be like, oh, I posted this on Facebook because obviously I know a lot of liberals. And in general, some of them were like, that's so dumb. And there was a guy who was like, that's obviously dumb, but it doesn't matter. And the problem is that this article was from Fox News. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, you see someone like Lena Dunham saying this and you're like, this is dumb. But it becomes a huge, huge deal to the other side and forms what their stereotype about you is.
Yeah.
And so it's this, you know, or
did they, do you know what the outcome of this Oberlin College bullshit was?
I don't remember. I mean, yeah. You know, they argued about it because apparently, and the worst part was that a lot of the complaint was the fact that the sushi was not done to the right level. It wasn't good enough sushi, and that's why it was culturally insulting.
It's just incredible.
And it's dining hall food. Dining hall food
just,
is bad.
It's just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so,
good job, Oberlin. Go, yeah. Good job.
But the point is, and you know, in general, a lot of these elite colleges have sort of gone down this rabbit hole, right? This whole social justice warrior thing. And the problem is that it gives any sort of educated person not necessarily the best name.
That's right.
Right. It damages the reputation of
the
whole
group.
Well,
it's not this kind of stand and this philosophy is not useful.
No.
It's actually completely. It lacks applicability. You can't 100%. Apply it to anything. It makes the world less fun. It mm-hmm. makes the world more ignorant.
And it's not grounded in history. And the point is that
it's not grounded in any truth, actually.
And if you want trust and relationships between cultures, then cultural exchange is a good way to achieve that. And food is a big part of that.
Yeah.
But there's a huge tendency to underestimate bad actors in our group giving us a bad name. So I don't know if you remember, for example, the guy down in Florida who was doing terrible things to the Quran, right? Burning it, flushing down the toilet. The point is, for an American, you see that, you're like, I have no particular emotional relationship to the Quran.
Yeah.
I don't care. This is silly. This guy is a Yahoo. Why do we care?
Yeah.
But that thing played nonstop in the Middle East. It was a big, big, big deal in the Arab world. And so what ends up happening is that, you know, this is exactly how terrorists work. Yeah. They're able to create stereotypes around the other group and stereotypes around your group so that you set people at odds with each other. The majority of Arabs, one of the big questions is always, why don't Arabs come out and like more strongly denounce terrorism? And it's because if you're an Arab, you're surrounded by Arabs.
It's not
like,
just that. It's also, you know, why then as a white person am I not in the streets scolding police officers?
Right.
I mean, it's not how human beings behave.
Well,
I have kids to feed.
It can be.
Yeah, but I mean, now is that going to make, first of all, you know, I don't know that many Arabs in the street feel like they could make a difference. It might be unsafe. It might be over there and not over here. There are a thousand things.
I think the point is that groups in general in the age of social media, like the Emiratis are doing, need to police their own brands. I think you need to, like, if you're, for example, I've talked before about how I don't think that Sam Harris and, you know, the New Atheists do science any credit, because I taught kids who were at Oaks Christian, a school that was set up to, you know, teach creationism. And the point is,
Oaks Christian is set up to
teach creationism.
It does?
Yeah.
Oaks Christian?
Yeah, Oaks Christian.
Oaks Christian is a very expensive school, and they're not teaching evolution.
They teach the controversy, and so they teach that there are four theories on the origins of the Earth.
Adam and Eve.
No, there's young Earth creationism, which is the belief that the Earth is only 6,000.
They teach this?
Oh, yeah. They teach that there are four theories, and you should make up your own mind, because still a lot of doubt, right? So it goes back to, do you remember Naomi Oreskes and, you know, Merchants of Doubt? That's what they're doing. It's the same thing as what the tobacco scientists do. If you create doubt, then people don't have to make a decision.
Yeah.
And
so instead of saying the theory of evolution is about as much a theory as the theory of gravity.
Yeah. What they do is they say, oh, you know, there's
these
controversy.
Are all equal theories.
There are all these different ideas, you know, and yeah, it's there's.
But evolution has anybody who doesn't believe in evolution hasn't studied evolution.
But that's true for most of these things. And the point is that.
But creationism is not a theory.
Well,
it's not a theory.
Creationism is a theory, but the point is it's not necessarily a theory that's supported by evidence.
That's right. I mean, there are theories that are supported by massive amounts of data, and not only massive amounts of data, but you know, the theory of evolution is also supported by experiments that can be duplicated, that can be replicated.
But again, this
over
is
and
all
over
very
again.
Rationalist, Brian, and it makes sense. But what you've got to do is you have to understand, right? In order for ideas to move between groups, you need trust, And there's no trust between, you know, fundamentalist Christians and evolutionary scientists. They've destroyed it over the last 150 years. And so it doesn't matter if there's no change, there's no dialogue between them. There's no ability for them to be able
it's
to pass ideas.
It's very difficult, though. It's very difficult.
Well, it's not...
It would be very difficult for me to actually have a conversation with a Christian fundamentalist.
Well,
what I do is I go... Oh, you're a dum-dum.
But that's the problem is that's the challenge of this age. The point is when you have to teach these people and you actually have to teach this unit as a scientist, right? Then you are placed in a very difficult position.
Yeah.
Because now you have to teach in an entirely different way. You cannot rely on the authority of science, right? That basic intuition. You can't rely on anything that a kid cannot directly confirm with their own eyes. You have to be willing to be patient and sort of, you know, fight the long battle and just sort of move ideas one at a time, and if you can move ideas one at a time, then eventually you can start to change their mind. And crucially, and this is where the diffusion of innovations comes in, you have to offer things of practical value. You can't just talk about a theory. You have to be like, what can you spot, what can you see, and what's useful? So for example, right, one of the things that we've talked about before with John Haidt is that you have these big visible whites to your eyes, right, sclera. Right, and all animals have sclera, but human sclera are super obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And so the result is that we're really good at transmitting emotional information. Things like side eye that the internet talks about and eye rolls, that's only possible to be able to spot because you have these big visible whites to your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, you know, this social intelligence where we communicate ideas back and forth emotionally, why we're so good at it.
Yeah.
But it's funny how all of this talk
is still, in many ways, on the fringes. If you were to look at, take a macro perspective at the world,
mm-hmm.
what actually made people nicer to each other, you could make an argument, was the superstitions of religion.
That's 100%
true. You know, because for example, in Indonesia, there's that amazing documentary where he essentially talks to all the perpetrators of the violence against the quote-unquote communists in the 60s, and I think it was about a period of about 1 year,
mm-hmm.
when a million Indonesians who were suspected quote-unquote communists were butchered, were mostly hacked to death with machetes, buried alive, all kinds of stuff. And the people who did this, the Komando Aksi, who were essentially conscripts of the military,
mm-hmm.
civilian conscripts of the military, are running around free. The military people that perpetrated this massacre are all in power.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them are considered heroes and talk about themselves as though
of course.
They're heroes. And hacking all those people to death are he was interviewing all the leaders of the death. So a lot of people, when confronted with people they disagree with, just break out the guns and the machetes.
It's so much easier. And
yeah.
what we're talking about now, let's talk about why is nonviolence genius? Why is it so brilliant? Because what you do is you deprive the other side of the ability to form a story about you.
Well, you have to also first start with the idea that there isn't a difference. It's exactly like the more you learn about science, the less the division between black people and white people and brown people, it makes no sense.
Or between evolutionists and creationists in terms of their raw biological hardware.
Well, again, now you're getting back to, it's not so much what you think,
mm-hmm.
it's how you think.
100%.
So how you think, many times you may be thinking the exact same way
mm-hmm.
as your enemy, you're just coming to a different conclusion.
Right.
Right? So, which is based on your preconceptions of reality and life.
And so, what we really want to do is, the point is that, like, if you look at something like germ theory, right?
Yeah.
So this is one of science's big, big, big accomplishments.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a couple of things to realize that, you know, firstly, you know, science didn't do this on its own. A lot of it rests on the Columbian Exchange and all these crops like, you know, corn and tomatoes and potatoes coming over from the New World. So, you know, famine was, you know, a huge, huge problem in Europe for most of history. But once you introduce these big, big staple crops, suddenly people aren't starving as much.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore they can eat and they can think and they can reflect and they have the time to do things like science. Secondly, a large part of it is about tools. You need to have sufficiently good glassware in order to be able to make microscopes and do all these sorts of things. So it wasn't that people hadn't tried to figure out disease before. It's just that they literally didn't have the tools to be able to look at the stars or to be able to look down at things. So it what you start to realize is this was a huge collective global collaboration, right, that involved like the Aztecs and the Inca and the Maya.
Cultural appropriation.
Yeah, exactly. Or cultural trade and exchange. Mm. And so now you have a totally different feeling about it. And not only that, on top of that, you have to understand how germ theory actually works. What it does is it takes the disgust that we already have, the feeling of disgust, and it channels it to the right things. So I'm disgusted by poo, and I'm disgusted by rotted meat, and I wash my hands after I touch these things. So it's taking the disgust and channeling it to the right things, as opposed to the earlier theory that science had was the miasmatic theory, which was that bad smells cause disease. And so therefore, the behavior that came out of that was, let's put eau de toilette on everything. Let's cover up the smells. And if there are no smells, then people won't die.
Mm.
So what's happened is that that's really what science's job is, right, which it hasn't really done on its own. But is to essentially challenge those emotions towards the right things so we do the right things. So in the same way, you know, what is the response when two groups are fighting? What should you be doing? And this is where social intelligence comes back in. You should be talking. And that's what happens in a fight between a husband and wife. You can spend all the time in the world that you want fighting, but the only way that the problem actually starts to get solved is when you have intergroup dialogue and when you start to do perspective taking and you try and understand and you try and unravel the problem together. So what nonviolence does is that, yeah, it deprives people of this ability to make a narrative. But social media has meant that you now have to take nonviolence to the next level. It's not sufficient to not just kill people, right? Although that does help, right?
Yeah.
But on top of that, what you now have to do is you have to use nonviolence in your speech. And so you have to be, and that's where Sally, you know, was Sally Cohn? Is that who it is?
Yeah.
With emotional correctness?
Yeah.
That's why emotional correctness becomes important. Because now it's not only about, you know, am I, you know, what am I doing, like, physically in terms of violence? I have to stay in certain emotions. So I have to be patient. I have to, you know, be curious and try and understand your point of view. We have to do turn taking. I have to listen to you. I have to make sure that you're heard, right? And so it's like nonviolence 3.0 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's like a whole other level.
Then you have to reduce these things. You have to be a reductionist. So you can go through all that, but then what actually moves things forward is catchy phrases. For example, it used to be, and I'll give you some examples. It used to be that my son is hitting people,
mm-hmm.
and my first reaction is to say, "Hey, you little motherfucker!
Yeah,
the real world works like this.
Yeah,
you hit somebody, I'm going to send you through a fucking wall. And by the way, you're going to bed without dinner, and blah blah blah. That the old school way.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just fucking paddle that little fuck. You know, whatever parents did." But what happens with a guy like me who goes into one idea, which is beat force with force,
mm-hmm.
and men tend to, that tends to be their, you know, by the way, everybody, I don't hit my children, but that was traditionally, I'm going to take a, you know, I'm going to make him pay for it in one
right.
way or another. That set point gets changed when I hear somebody who knows a lot about child psychology say, punishment doesn't change behavior, it just suppresses it.
That's right.
And I go, wait, shit, I love this little kid.
I want him to be
successful in life. Tell me more.
Yeah.
You just got to me. You got to me with a sound bite.
That's right.
And I react to sound bites.
Right. And so let's get into some sound bites here.
Yeah.
Okay. So now
we should actually talk about what our Yeah.
And so now that we've talked about how bad people are at figuring these things out, right? In general, all humans are bad at causal reasoning.
I can't figure out what's wrong with a situation where a child's acting out. I don't
mm-hmm.
know how to. I have to talk to experts.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
But that humility is really what we need in this moment in terms of solving Black Lives Matter or any of these problems.
Yeah.
But humility from both sides, so they're trying to figure it out. And ultimately, one of the questions that they might ask themselves is, where does racism come from? right? And there are a lot of myths that float around about the origins of racism. But again, there are people who study this for their entire lives and try and figure out these questions. So let's go
like
through,
Jared Diamond, yeah.
Like Jared Diamond, right? And, you know, Charles C. Mann, who summarized the work of a whole bunch of other people, right? And a lot of this stuff goes back to Alfred Crosby. So, but the important point is that first, you have to deal with slavery. Right, slavery. You know, there's often a narrative that slavery was invented, right, with basically the triangle trade and African slavery.
No, it was not invented. No.
Slavery has always been around. It's in the Bible, yeah. Right? It's in fact, the word slave comes from the word Slav, right? And originally, that's because that was the other side of the spice trade. The Venetians used to go up into the Black Sea and they would grab Romanians and Ukrainians and all these other people.
All those other good-looking women.
And they would enslave them. And then they would go down and they would trade them for spices like cinnamon. Mm-hmm. So white slavery was a huge, huge thing. And in fact, white slavery, continued for a long time.
It's pretty hot. Keep going.
Yeah. Does that turn you on, Brian?
Sorry, buddy. Sorry.
I think you may have to start. It sounds like
I just caught my glimpse of myself in the mirror and I look like a Sicilian slave trader with my, with my beard and my pointy ears and anyway, keep going.
So slavery's been around forever.
Yeah.
Now, the issue is, what Charles C. Mann does in 1493, and you can read this book, but he basically asks the question, why did they enslave black people? Which is a really, really good question, because there were three systems of labor in the New World. The first system of labor was indentured servitude. And that was basically where you would say, "Hey, you want to come to the New World?
Work your freedom off.
Work your freedom off." Yeah. So you basically, this is pretty common. You basically work for 7 years and then you get freedom.
Which actually certain African Americans who came to the New World did.
Yeah. It was very popular.
And then they owned slaves.
And it was a very, indentured servitude was a very successful system because people are motivated, right? They're motivated to work hard.
Oops, sorry, everybody.
So they're motivated to work hard. They want to succeed and all of this sort of stuff. So and in fact, Adam Smith, who invented capitalism or who's called the founding father of capitalism, is very clear that slavery is a bad system, right? Mm-hmm. From a labor point of view. So there's this narrative that economic was driven by pure economics, but it's actually a bad system because slaves don't like to be enslaved. They have a tendency to avoid work because screw you guys. They break machinery and they find all these acts of rebellion and resistance.
Damn slaves. Well that historian has said, there is no such thing as a slave. There's only people in bondage who are always trying to get out of their situation. It's like when did the civil rights movement start in this country, the United States? The first African slave hit land. Nobody wants to be a slave.
Well, and
I've had some sexual partners. That's just play acting. Yeah. And then they go back to having their own thoughts.
And that also brings us to drapetomania, right? So do you know what drapetomania is?
Sure don't, but I'm very excited.
So drapetomania...
I felt a rush in my loins.
It was a psychological condition they came up with for the desire of a slave to run away. They said that it was a sickness and that the sickness could be cured and treated, right?
It's called human.
It's called being human. Yeah. Humans want to be free. And that's, to your point. But so... The point is that's why, from a labor standpoint, slavery is never a particularly good system because people aren't motivated.
Yes, right.
So the question is, this indentured servitude system becomes very popular in the North. So the question is, why does it not become popular in the South? Right. And let's imagine that you're just a dick and you just want to enslave people for the sake of enslaving people. Well, why wouldn't you enslave Native Americans who are already there? Right. If you don't want to have labor costs, right, that's a cheaper way to do it. Mm-hmm. And so, there was some of that was going on, but ultimately it wasn't the most successful system, in part because a lot of these Native Americans had been wiped out by diseases and other forms of genocide that were perpetrated by white Europeans. But so we've now got two systems, right? But still, what happens is that the system that becomes popular is the third system, which is that you go all the way across the Atlantic, and then you get these people and you bring them into the least motivating form of labor.
Yeah.
So why is it that they choose what is by, any sort of economic...
Well, also, you're putting them in the hulls of ships.
Yeah.
You're doing something you've got to know is immoral. They're dying. It's actually, from a business standpoint, not a good idea.
Yep.
Yeah.
So why do they choose this third system, which is actually the worst system economically?
You've also got to go into the jungle and get malaria and yellow fever. It's the white man's graveyard.
And that right there is exactly the issue. And the issue is that when this Columbian Exchange happened, when crops like, you have crops like tomato and corn and potatoes, and they're going over to Europe, but there are also, there's a whole mixing of species that happens. Mm-hmm. And one of the species that gets mixed is that all the diseases from Africa end up being transferred to the South. So malaria used to be a huge, huge, huge problem in the southern states of the United States. And so over time, not by any sort of particular conscious thought, this system of slavery evolves that favors using Africans.
Because they have that sickle cell. They have the
it's
ability.
Not just sickle cell. There's a whole range of genes that they
that,
have.
That has made them resistant to malaria.
To malaria.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And other diseases.
I didn't know malaria was a major problem.
It was a huge problem, and then they had to drain the swamps, and they had to do all that sort of stuff, and they have ultimately eradicated malaria
once
in the South.
Once they figured out
that it was caused. Well, then again, to go back to the miasmatic theory, malaria, right? Which is Italian for bad air. Uh-huh. They used to think that it was just sort of the air that caused it. It took a long time for people to figure out that
I didn't know malaria was an issue in the New World.
It was a huge issue, as was yellow fever. They used to call malaria
tertian
fever.
It was brought over, though, by mosquitoes from Africa.
Yeah, I mean, well, you have the...
Larva.
Well, no, it's not even necessarily that. Remember, there are mosquitoes already in the New World, right? So it's possible some mosquito, you know, gets transferred over. But it's also that, you know, you may have an African guy who has it in his blood, and then the mosquito bites him. And then, you know, it gets transferred around.
Okay.
So, but this system evolves over time. And the interesting thing is, and I emailed Charles C. Mann, there's actually a random thing that's floating on the internet, as there are so many interesting random answers floating around. But it seems like the same system evolved around the oases in the Arabian Peninsula to favor African slaves because they had this malarial resistance.
That's interesting.
So...
but they would have to know that... They would have somebody had to make that causal effect
connection. That's the whole point of cultural evolution is that people don't necessarily you remember the whole thing about pellagra?
Yeah.
Right? So the point is that the Aztecs are mixing wood ash in with their corn.
Yeah.
And they don't know why. It's just the thing that their people do.
Yeah, it's custom, yeah.
And so what happens is these customs evolve, and they're a response to the environment, and they solve a particular problem. But it's not that anybody, again, because we're not good at being rational, so it's not that anybody plans any of these things out. They just sort of develop over time. And then what happens is, and this is where you get into, you know, implicit racism, these things are passed on emotionally from generation to generation to generation to generation. And there's an amazing thing on John Oliver where he was doing a whole thing about Brexit, right? John Oliver does Last Week Tonight, right?
Yeah, he's great.
Anyway,
he's
so,
great.
And he has this clip of this British woman, and she's on there, and she's like, the one thing I can't stand, like the people I just can't stand, are Negroes. And I don't know why.
I don't know why.
But that's
the
literally
skin.
Yeah, but the point is that she has an emotional feeling about black people, and she literally has no rational explanation because it's not rational; it's emotional.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as what we have in all of our families, which is that there's stuff that we pick up from our parents that we picked up somehow
because human beings are not rational.
No,
they are intuitive. They are emotional. And so in order to get the important ideas to move,
mm-hmm.
and in order to get the important ideas into your own brain, you've got to figure out a way to either put your emotions aside mm-hmm. or recognize that they are what is stopping you,
but also,
or also what motivates you.
How does a person deal with their family shit? So I'll tell you a story. So when my dad and I, you know, when we lived in London, we would always race through dinner, right? And then we would race through dessert because we had a 3-person family and we would always cut dessert into 4. So everybody always wanted the fourth piece, right?
Yeah.
And so my mother would sit there and be like, you two are eating like pigs. Why are you doing this? This is so weird. And what we ultimately figured out is that this is stuff that somehow my father had picked up from his own mother, who had lived through the famine of 1944 in Holland during the Second World War.
When kids stopped growing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she this woman had an, I mean, you know, my grandmother had this amazingly strong paranoia and control issues with food. She used to physically padlock our fridge.
Sure.
Right? And it's all totally understandable, yeah, having gone through what the Dutch call the hunger winter, right?
Hunger winter.
Yeah. I mean, Dutch is about like three steps from English.
Yeah, it is.
Right? So, you
hunger
know.
Hunger winter.
But so they, you know, she had this amazing emotional relationship, and these feelings about food and these control issues about food had been passed on to my father and had been passed on to me. Now, that's three generations.
God damn.
But a lot of this stuff, you know, goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's like that British woman. They're racist and they don't know why.
Customs.
Right. But the point is that, you know, does my mother try and shame this behavior? No, she does not. She wants to talk through this behavior. Because fundamentally what shame does, it makes us bury and avoid things.
Yeah.
Right? And so the yeah. counterintuitive thing, if you really want to deal with racism, right, is that we all have to talk this out. And even
it's
though
it's exactly like dealing with a child who's acting out, the tendency would be to say, he's being an asshole,
yep,
and I'm going to treat him like one so he stops until he stops being one.
That's right.
I'm going to punish him until he starts being a good boy.
That's right.
Because I want to impose my ideas on him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to ignore, well, it's actually the equivalent of killing a bunch of communists with machetes with your Komando Aksi in Indonesia. It actually is.
Yeah.
Again, that the way I was thinking,
mm-hmm,
the frustration that led me to think that way, I was thinking, I was using the same methodology,
mm-hmm,
as the Komando Aksi were using in Indonesia. So I was horrified to see them treating, quote unquote, their problem, which was a communist insurrection or communist, you know, movement, in such a brutal fashion, which
right.
was just get rid of them.
That's right.
And in a way, when you say that the kid's being a jerk, let's punish him and make him sit in a chair and not move, the methodology in your brain is very similar to mm-hmm. the people you're criticizing.
Of course.
Instead of saying, let me see what's really going on. Let me put my emotions aside and figure out what his incentive structures are,
mm-hmm,
and why he is behaving this way, which requires actually some investigation into how his mind works.
Well, and ultimately what you come to realize is that his mind works not so differently from you.
That's right.
And the whole idea, what we're trying to get to in America, is back to the idea that all people are created equal. But in order to really do that, you have to understand the fact that if you had grown up in that person's environment and had their circumstances.
I have a tennis teacher who, when parents are getting mad at their 8-year-old for not hitting the ball well, he takes the parent and puts the, he says, what hand are you? And says, I'm a right-hander. And he puts the racket in their left hand and says, now I want you to start hitting
yeah.
some balls. And the balls go all over the fucking
yeah,
place
terrible.
And they miss them. And he goes, that's how your kid feels.
Yeah.
Now you got it. Now take a step back and let me teach your kid.
Of course.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's ultimately about dealing with all this stuff, and that all obviously the consequences of racism are terrible. But do we want to wait another 300 years before really dealing with the root issue, or do we want to actually deal with it? And if we actually want to deal with it, there's all sorts of great tools that science has. For example, there's what's called implicit association test. And so what the implicit association test is that you're given a series of words, right, and you try and associate, for example, good with black. And how long does it take you to associate good with black as opposed to, you know, white with bad or any of these sorts of things? And by doing this whole test, you could basically find out that you have some sort of implicit racism.
Right.
But the crucial thing is that you don't necessarily even have to fix your racism to start having the benefits of it. So there's a book called Wait, and in that book called Wait, they tell a story about doctors who are not giving as good medical care to black people. But once they take the IAT and they're aware that they have this bias, then they can deliberately start to counteract it, and then the level of care goes back to what it should be.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all sorts of things that we can do, and science can help with these things, and it can support these things. But again, you're not going to find the answer from any one scientist. You're going to have to find it by going around a whole bunch of science to start to get a clearer picture.
So until next time, give us an assignment that we
yeah.
can do to improve our MMA for the minds, that we can become better mixed martial artists.
Well, I think the two biggest challenges are to figure out who are the people in your group, whatever group that you particularly identify, who give your group a bad name, right? And then, you know, how would you deal with them? And then the other thing is think about the group that you despise, whatever it may be, and try and understand why it is that they have reached the conclusions about your group that they have. So how are they forming their stereotypes about you? Who are they picking out? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, try and figure out why, you know, your enemy thinks that you are a certain way, which you don't feel is true.
And then ask yourself if your methodology, if your thought methodology is in fact the same, you're just reaching different conclusions.
Right.
That's another question. Hunter Motz, you're a good man. And thank you for illuminating us once again.
Well, knowledge is power, Brian Callen, and that's what we're going to give to people who study mixed mental arts.
Any
power.
Of you, any vegetarians out there, I apologize about the deer story, but it died. It died well. And that's really what the point is. Die well.
And did you honor its spirit, Brian? That's the real thing.
Yes, by butchering it and eating the shit out of it with a fantastic 2000 Chateau Angelus.
Oh, wow.
Don't bother trying to buy that. It'll cost you $2,000 in a fucking restaurant.
Did you pay for that?
Sure didn't. Got a rich friend. Ladies and gentlemen, it's all about having rich friends, big guns, and walls. Vote Trump, everybody.
Yeah, that was the real message. Watch this, Brian. Just you wait. Like, this is the internet. Someone's going to excerpt
no!
that.
God damn it. All right, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you later.
All right. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.